I want to talk about today, we've been looking at some themes from Abante's talk, Buddhism, World Peace and Nuclear War, which we listened to way back in summer, way back in June, and thought there were some sort of basic themes that would be really good to explore further. There was so much in that talk. I think it would be a whole Buddhism course based on that talk. But today's the last of three talks that I'm drawing out some themes from Bante. And this is the theme, I think the final theme is some, well, towards the end of the talk, I mean, Bante has talked about the importance of working towards non-violence, the importance of going beyond identification with particular nationalisms, the importance of identifying with humanity as a whole. Last time I talked about this teaching about the importance of valuing objective truth, which is an extraordinarily current kind of theme. But as he concludes the talk, what he's talking about is that even if we did solve the problem of nuclear war, of any war, even if we solved problems of any problem in the world, poverty, even if we solved the problem of climate change, all of those are, well, we need to do all those things, we're still left with problems, you know, we're still left with sort of basic human dilemmas. And he finishes the talk by looking at these, and there are two basic themes that he draws out. One is, so what do we do with our lives? So what is a worthwhile life? What does it mean to live a worthwhile life? And the other is, of course, how do we face the fact that we are mortal, that we're all going to die? So this is what I want to talk about today. You know, the kind of underlying, I suppose, existential dilemmas that we have. Last week I was on a women's order weekend, area order weekend, and it was on a theme that I suddenly, it suddenly crystallised what I maybe want to say in this talk. It's on the theme of bodhicitta, which you probably heard, you may have heard or come across that word before, will to enlightenment, or it's sometimes translated as awakening mind. A kind of transpersonal force that works towards enlightenment, which we can tap into. And it came to my mind a couple of verses from the Bodhicharyavatara, which is a work devoted particularly to this theme of bodhicitta. So I just want to read them to start with. At night, in darkness thick with clouds, a lightning flash gives a moment's brightness. So sometime, by the power of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of merit. This being so, the power of good is always weak, while the power of evil is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that, were there not the perfect awakening mind? Awakening mind is a translation of bodhicitta. So this is a couple of verses which sounds pessimistic in a way, the power of good being weak and the power of evil being vast and terrible, and in a way there's no hope without the awakening mind, without enlightenment. In a sense it's saying the same kind of thing that Bante is saying, that even if we solve all the problems that we're faced with in conditioned existence, we're still faced with this basic, well, what do we do? You know, what is it that really ultimately gives meaning to our lives? What really solves the basic kind of underlying problem of death? And in a way, these two questions, what to do with our lives and how to face death, they're linked, aren't they? They're very uh, that they're in a sense two sides of the same question. Why do we avoid, why do we get sort of caught up in triviality? It's because reality is quite hard to face, you know, our end is quite hard to bear. And I said in the talk, it would be a thousand pities if we solved the problem of world peace and spent our time playing bingo, watching third-rate television. I think we could add quite a few things to that list nowadays. I was just reflecting. There's this sort of well-known kind of saying that the Buddha said that were there any drive stronger than the sexual drive, humanity would be rather done for. And I kind of worry sometimes that we found it. Apparently some young people are preferring gaming online to sex. So, you know, the internet is such a powerful source of trivia and distraction. It's quite, really hope that it's not stronger than the sexual drive, but it's a bit worrying. So this is what I want to talk about, really. How do we, what does it mean to kind of face these kind of existential problems? I once had a question when I was going to see Sandra Achita. It's been something I've been thinking about. Because it struck me that all of my basic problems came down to a fear. Fear of death, basically. And I was wondering if you could say that overcoming that fear was synonymous with insight, with enlightenment, would be a different aspect of the same experience. And so I asked him that question, and he said, yes, you could say that, as long as it was genuine, you know, as long as it wasn't, I suppose, avoiding, you know, denying, not facing up to, and so forth. So I found that interesting. So how then does the Dharma address this basic kind of existential problem that we all have? Quite simply, quite straightforwardly, it says that all our problems arise from clinging. All our suffering arises from clinging. Clinging on to selfhood. Clinging on to a notion of continued existence. Many religions solve this problem by, in a sense, kind of constructing a sort of eternal life, you know, beyond death. In a sense, they kind of solve the problem by avoiding it, by denying it. So you could say that the traditional teaching, Buddhist teaching on rebirth, is another version of this. But of course, in Buddhism, an endless cycle of rebirth is not seen as a particularly desirable or joyful option. And it's interesting this. Some years ago, something quite strange happened. My son was about 9 or 10 years old. And that's my older son, Dan. He was having a nightmare. And I went into his room and he woke up and he was crying from this nightmare. And he said, when he was in a fit state to tell me what the nightmare was, he said, I was just dreaming and I was realising that I either just die or I just go on and on and on forever. And both of those seemed equally terrible. I was really staggered by what he was saying, actually. I was staggered. Because, you know, he'd kind of had some kind of dream which was about those two extremes of the Buddha teachings of nihilism and eternalism. Mm-hmm. We either just come to an end or we just go on and on forever, just as we are now. And both of those are, you know, the two extremes that the Buddha said we go beyond. Contemplating impermanence is one of our greatest impetuses to practice the Dharma. I was talking to a friend last week who had suddenly come up with some symptoms that she suddenly needed to go to hospital and have lots of tests and scans and this and that. She said that previously she was reflecting on Padma Sandhava and his advice to pay urgent attention to impermanence. And she said, all of a sudden I realised I hadn't been paying urgent attention to impermanence at all. This experience was, that was urgent attention to impermanence. So, yeah, but the Dharma requires us to face up to this. So I think the questions are the method of how to let go of this kind of basic self-clinging. And it's an interesting question, because the truth is there are many, many ways. There are a number of different ways. And there is a lot of discussion on this topic within the order at the moment on insight and seeing through self-clinging. So I just want to go through some of these ways, just to look at them. So one method is, I suppose, what we could call the cognitive method. It's where we use our minds. We use our minds to analyse our experience. We use our minds to see, convince ourselves without a shadow of a doubt that everything within our experience is genuinely impermanent, is genuine, substantial, and isn't ultimately satisfactory. So it's the method where we contemplate the three actions. We see that that this is true, and we keep coming back to convincing ourselves that this is true. Gradually, as we do that, this cognitive method, it gradually filters down into our experience. It gradually becomes more and more of our experience. It's quite important, using this method, that we don't mistake knowing something intellectually, knowing something with our minds, for that a more in-depth experience. Nonetheless, to continually remind ourselves of these facts, it has that effect over time. It does gradually sink down into and become part of experience. So this is one method. It's by reflecting on our experience within in those ways. There's another method, which is the ethical path, I suppose. The path of looking at our actions, looking at our ethics in the light of the precepts, and gradually refining our sensitivity by following the precepts, refining our sensitivity to the way our actions have consequences, the way our actions affect other people. Gradually our behaviour changes, and we're sort of aligning ourselves with the truth that actions have consequences, and that as we become more sensitive to that, our kind of selfhood tends to attenuate. It becomes more important to act ethically than to preserve a sense of self. There's another method, which is meditation. When we meditate, what we're doing is we're tapping into our ongoing experience, what's really going on in our mind, what the nature of our mind is. So through meditation, gradually we can also attenuate selfhood through just that direct experience of constant change. Our experience is constantly changing. There's nothing in it that's stable, solid. It's all fluid. There's nothing we can hold on to. And then there's the way of faith. The way of faith, imagination, devotion. Our intuitive response to the truth of Buddha's teaching. Our intuitive knowledge that this is the path to follow, and our willingness to kind of surrender to that and feel the gratitude and the devotion that arises when we contemplate the Buddha and the other figures that are representative of enlightenment, the more imaginal figures as well, which represent different qualities of enlightenment. Through that faith and devotion, we kind of open ourselves up more and more to that influence and make ourselves more and more permeable and become more and more like a Buddha or a Bodhisattva ourselves. There's the path of beauty, of course, the path of beauty and creativity. You know, we can see enlightenment as just ultimately beautiful, open ourselves up to that. It's a very attractive prospect, and creativity, we can often have a sense that that what we're doing is bringing something into being that's beyond our everyday selves. That's enough. And there's also the path of altruism, the path of work, the path of losing self-preoccupation by working for the goods of others, paying attention to the needs of others, selling charity in a charity shop, you know, be it working in a team, overcoming preferences by even being up against other people, all those sorts of. There's a really beautiful passage that I remembered by George Bernard Shaw, where he talks about this. He says, "This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose, recognised by yourself as a mighty one, being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, but the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle for me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I have got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations." That's quite to be pinned on the wall. It used to be in the wall, actually, in the basement. That's why I remembered it. And then, of course, there's finally just the way of living life with awareness, living our life with a kind of reflective awareness of what it's like, you know, to be alive and to be human, and to notice our experience, notice the world around us, and notice that everything changes, and notice that we change, and notice that there is actually no self to cling on to. We just live life. So these are various ways of letting go of self-clinging, and as you can see, there's quite a wide range, and that's because there's a very wide range of people, aren't there? We're all actually different, and different methods appeal to us or affect us differently. I must say it's one of the reasons that I'm so grateful to Sangharakshita for what he's taught, because he's given us this wide range. There's no particularly strong focus on, you know, meditation is the path, or, you know, reflection is the path, or social action is the path within Tri Ratna. There's a range of paths, and we can sensitively and with the help of friends, you know, sort of establish what's our path, what works for us. But it's very important that we respect all of these different methods. Don't think that our method is the right method, you know, and other people's method is the wrong method. There's this beautiful passage from a sutra called Vimalakirti Nideja, where all of these young men are approaching the Buddha to worship him, and they're all carrying parasols. I think it must have been a mark of respect or something like that. They're carrying these beautiful parasols. They're called the Lichavi youths. And they're approaching the Buddha with these parasols. And the Buddha, seeing them coming, performs this miracle in which all of these individual parasols combine to sort of make a great, mighty parasol, which covers the hole, which extends in every direction. And when you looked into this parasol, you saw all of the universities, all of the towns, all of the villages, all of the forests, all of everything, everything just reflected in this mighty parasol. Everything that you could imagine was in this mighty parasol. And when Bhante's talked about this, it's a bit like these individual parasols are our own individual aspirations. You know, we're each carrying a parasol. This is my aspiration. And the Buddha's power converts them all into one great aspiration. And this is bodhicitta. This is the a symbol for bodhicitta. That all of our individual aspirations combine to form something far greater than the sum of the parts. And it's really sad if we get into a parasol fight, isn't it? There's no need to get into a parasol fight. So, what letting go of self does not mean letting go into big, blank nothingness. That, you know, we just let go of self and there's nothing left. Something seems to happen as we become less and less attached to our selfhood. What we realise is that there are other people out there, but there's something else. There's a kind of, it's hard to say, isn't it? There's bodhicitta. There's a force. There's compassion. There's something beyond ourselves which can then be free to work through us. We get ourselves out of the way, and compassion can work through us. Bodhicitta can work through us. And it's not a binary thing. It's not like you either are or you aren't, you know, free of self and a means for bodhicitta. To some degree, we can do it. We can let go of self, and to some degree, bodhicitta works through us. In the Bodhicharya, it talks about bodhicitta, not as, you know, may it arise. It's already at work in the world. It has already arisen. That's what it's saying. It has already arisen. And it's at work. There's a poem that Bhante wrote, which I think expresses some of this. A wind was in my sails. It blew stronger and fiercer, hour by hour. I did not know from whence it came, or why. I only knew its power. Sometimes it dashed me on the rocks. Sometimes it spun me round and round. Sometimes I laughed aloud for joy. Sometimes I felt a peace profound. It drove me on, that manic wind, when I was young. It drives me still, now I'm old. It lives in me. Its breath, my breath. Its will, my will. Just really wanting to go back to that first quotation, where I read, this being so, the power of good is always weak, the power of evil is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that, were there not the perfect awakening mind? Somebody on the order weekend was talking about an experience she'd had where she'd been on retreat for quite a while. She'd been on a 3-month ordination retreat, and then she'd been on a 2-month solitary retreat. And during that time she'd done a lot of meditation and reflection. And what she'd got to during this last solitary retreat was a very raw, painful feeling. This is what happens sometimes when you go on solitary retreat, it's not all bliss. She found that she got to a very raw, painful feeling, and she, in kind of working out what it was, she realised that at the bottom, she didn't care if anyone else died as long as she lived. And it was a sort of moment of real truth, like, this is the reality. You know, I can pretend I'm a nice person. I can pretend that I want the best for others. But that it was almost, she described it, a relief to get to this kind of raw, basic feeling, because she also felt that it wasn't particularly personal to her. It was more what life is like. It wants to save itself. Life in itself sort of wants to save itself, wants to preserve itself. She realised that this is the level that our Dharma practice needs to get to. It needs to get right down to that kind of almost basic cellular level where we sort of fundamentally want to save ourselves, you know, preserve ourselves. But she remembered this phrase of the Buddha's about the turning around in the deepest seat of consciousness. That this is what ultimately needs to turn around. So it's really not to underestimate this task. It's quite a demanding task. However, it's also possible. It can be attained. And I think I've seen it myself. I've seen it in my friend who died, Asanga Shila, as he was approaching death. I once asked him, I think I've told you this, some of you this before, I asked him, are you afraid? And he said, it's not like that at all. Because while I'm aware of other people and wanting to die well for them, there's nothing to fear at all. And, you know, it was a struggle for him to get to that, but it's also a possibility to get to that. So this... what I want to express is that this is possible, that, and at times we can feel a sense of huge relief when we do, for a period of time, just let go of self-clinging and let go of our self-concern. Sometimes we have that sense of something that is way beyond our normal clinging mind. I remember Subhuti saying about his mum, as she was quite old, and she said to him one day, you know, I'm just so fed up of me. You know, we get that, don't we? Just get so fed up of me, you know, me going round and round and round in our mind. But sometimes we just do have a sense of that just falling away, and what a relief it is when it does. You know, mm-hmm. It does. Subhuti wrote this puja, it's called a Going for Refuge puja, and there's some words in that I always come back to, because I think it expresses this beautifully and memorably. He says, to condemn my own mind, which is free and open as the sky, to the narrowness of ordinary thought, is very suffering itself. To condemn myself having the destiny of a Buddha to this narrow, dusty sphere of self is suffering. Mm-hmm. It is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is, in a way, the kind of bottom level of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness. We just sense that we're capable of so much more than our daily experience. Mm-hmm. We sense that we have a huge untapped potential, and all of our kind of limitations and trivialities can get in the way of that. And this is what we're practicing the Dharma for, to release that huge untapped potential. So, I've got that much more to say. I think I've said all I wanted to. And what I'd like us to do now is a bit of an exercise, okay? So this is, I'd like us to take a question. And the question I'd like us to take is, what difference does it make when I remember impermanence? That's the question I'd like you to take. And Amara Pushpa is going to explain to you how we're going to contemplate that question. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Such a surprise. No, I did check it out before.
We could either do the we'll do the reflection now, because it was all, so what we're going to do first of all is to do do this as a reflection. So in Buddhism, reflection is, as you say, halfway between cognitive, turning something over our mind, and meditation. So it's one of those methods that Vijayashi was talking about in terms of moving towards insight. So it was quite important to really stay connected with our bodies and just drop that reflection in. You know, what difference does it make to me to when I contemplate impermanence? And we'll do that for about 5 minutes. And then should I explain the rest now?
Okay.
Or maybe, yeah. Maybe after the 5 minutes?
Maybe after.
After.
Yeah. So we settle down as for meditation. And this is the question that we are contemplating. What difference does it make when I remember impermanence? like with meditation, when our minds wander, we come back patiently to the question.
So something may or may not have come up in response to the question. And in a lot of ways with reflection, it's just dropping in the question and just waiting. It's kind of a deep listening and just honoring whatever. It doesn't necessarily, might not even relate to the question. It's just really honoring what comes up in response to it. And we're now going to be in... just break into pairs, and what we're going to do is one person will go first and just say what came up, whatever it was that came up in response to that question, and the other person is just listening metaphorically, you know, it's just being as wholeheartedly with that person listening. And then after the 3 or 4 minutes I'll ring the gong. And the person listening, if they'd like, they can ask a few questions about what the other person said. I'm trying as much to stay with what the person actually said, but it may be something may have come up for you in response. You might check it out with the person. Well, does that resonate? And you do that for, I guess, another 3 or 4 minutes, and then we'll switch. So let's make sure everybody has two. Could you all find a partner? And if we don't end up equal, we'll see what we can do to make. So you two, yeah. Okay. We have a few minutes left. I think we're going to go back, have a mantra then.
Yeah. Well, we're going to just finish with it. Actually, what I'd like to do before we do mantra is just a few verses from this refuge puja of Subhutis. We'll do that in call and response, and then I'll lead the Pranya Paramita mantra. She's on the shrine. She stands for the perfection of wisdom. She's good. So this is taking refuge from suffering.
All that lives must die.
All that lives must die.
Every beginning has an ending.
Every beginning has an ending.
My last day will be a day like any other. And life will continue.
Without me.
Knowing this. I see no lasting happiness in this life. So I go for refuge. To the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Life itself is suffering. To be amidst duality is suffering. To condemn my own mind. Which is free and open as the sky. To the narrowness of ordinary thought. Is very suffering itself.
To condemn myself.
Having the destiny of a Buddha. To this narrow, dusty sphere of self.
Is so much suffering.
Knowing this. I see no lasting happiness in this life. So I go for refuge. To the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I shall take my stand. In emptiness, needing nothing. Reveling in the joy. Of liberated mind. Glorying in the bliss. Of illuminated mind. Wondering at the mystery. Of unconditioned mind.
Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha.
Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha.
Thank you, Vijayashri.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.